The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The sell-off in Tesla shares has been sharp and swift. Stock sits about 18% below Monday's close. It has lost roughly $85 billion in market cap since then. The stock still up about 800% over the last year.
The unemployment rate dropped to 8.4%, the first time it's dipped into single digits since the start of the pandemic.
The CDC is informing state leaders that a vaccine is on its way and to start preparing for distribution. The government calls it Operation Warp Speed.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks continue their sell-off on Friday despite a better-than-expected report on unemployment. The economy created 1.4 million jobs last month, and the unemployment rate unexpectedly dropped to 8.4%. from 10.2% in July. Well, despite the good economic news, investors continue to dump overvalued technology shares. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari believes stocks are still in an uptrend despite the recent sell-off this week. He sees the internals of the market basing outside of technology, with low interest rates providing a floor underneath this market. Dave Morgan will also be joining me today as we look at silver, which Dave feels has a ways to run, but also a look at copper. If you're thinking green, copper is the new green that's going to power all those EVs. And Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will discuss current macro events in another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. You know, it's crazy these days when a bear market recession lasts 4 weeks and a bull market crash lasts 1.5 days. Chalk it up for just another 2020 meme. Before the correction started, the NASDAQ was up 34.4% year-to-date on Wednesday. Not a bad return given the recession. And the NASDAQ fell 9.8% from Wednesday's closing high, all-time high, to the intraday bottom Friday at 10,875. It came within inches of its 50-day moving average for the NASDAQ, which was a near touch and go. And go it went to close back up to 11,313. Is the correction over? Big question. Possibly, or we could be in a consolidation that could last a little longer than a couple of days as the market goes sideways. You know, we are anticipating some uncertainty surrounding the election, and the market abhors uncertainty. In the 2016 election, the S&P fell 5% heading into the election. I have a few clients that have even requested 100% cash positions, and my reminder right now is set for November 5th to give them a call, as long as we have, obviously, a clear winner. Moving on, there were no root causes for the correction other than a market that was extended and due a correction. There were some flags that things were extended, such as an equity put-to-call ratio that hit new lows relative to 2011 and 2014, signaling just greed. And I heard some trader talk that the reason for that was due to crowding of out-of-money call options purchased on individual stocks. Jim Cramer even called it stupid money on Thursday. If you're going to speculate, options are the place. So that's why we monitor them and the volatility index. On that note, the volatility index climbed 15% on, guess what day? Monday, as protection demand rose ahead of where things were this week. In other news, not that there was really any big items other than the tech stocks and mega cap stocks dragging everything down on Thursday and Friday. But yes, there were other pieces of news worth noting. Let's talk economics, because it's my hope, big hope, that the stock market can round out its performance, not just in tech, but in cyclical areas that have great valuations at levels still well below the February highs. One example that is with the financials, with a widening yield curve due to stronger economics and Jerome Powell's announcement last week for an average inflationary target of 2%. The S&P 500's financial sector was up 0.8% on Friday, given the correction on Friday at the close, which led the end-of-day rally. Tuesday's ISM Manufacturing Index for August rose 56%, which was good news considering we saw a couple of regional numbers drop in August over the past few weeks, and of course, consumer sentiment that was down. Overall, a good sign there. China's manufacturing PMIs rose to 53.1 in August, a new high for the year, which is another good sign that the global recovery effort since trade wars and since COVID-19 continue to improve there for China, as well as, again, the global economy. China's services have cooled down a bit since their 10-year record high in June. Services are still holding above 50 at 54, which is, again, an expansionary reading. Materials were the best performing sector on Tuesday as a result of all this news on manufacturing for our ISM numbers as well as China's numbers. Materials rose 2.8% as a sector. Factory orders increased 6% in July with a rise of 1.9% on new orders, excluding aircraft. Unemployment claims dropped nicely, down 130,000 to 881,000, which is the lowest level since COVID-19 forced the hard stop in March on the economy. Also on Thursday was the services ISM number for the U.S., which cooled slightly to 56.9, again, another level well above expansionary territory. And the big number that hit on Friday was the jobs report, showing an increase of 1.37 million jobs added. And the unemployment rate dropped to 8.4% for August from 10.2% in July. Solid economic numbers overall for the week, and definitely not adding to the concerns with the correction, which was purely technical this week, with real no fundamental data to support the concern. On the earnings front, Zoom crushed earnings as working from home continues to set analysts back a few feet trying to model and price out growth. Zoom's revenues grew 355% from a year ago. Wow. And their rising adoption going on from large enterprises signing multi-year contracts. Their gross margin expanded 72.3% in the second quarter as they focus on data center capacity. What's funny is the company is modeling 3.6% revenue growth next quarter. Yeah, 3.6. Is that going to happen? Probably, I don't know. Let's extrapolate. Their last quarter revenue grew twofold. It just shows you it's really difficult right now for management. They're being conservative, as well as for any analyst right now trying to put a number on growth for the company. Their stock, when I was looking at it, grew was up 50% after their earnings report. I think it closed 40% up, and of course corrected the following day. Macy's was another highlight this week, showing not all department stores are created equal in a post-Amazon dominated world. Their online sales really helped to offset their in-store losses in the second quarter, and their store sales improved versus the first quarter, showing that customers were starting to come back. It wasn't as bad in the second quarter. For the numbers, Macy's e-commerce channel grew 53%, helping offset that 61% drop in store sales. Same quarter, let's talk about Nordstrom's. Nordstrom's online sales dropped 5% in e-commerce. So Macy's is definitely doing something right. Ciena is one of those companies having some difficulty navigating COVID. Most of its products are hardware and are sold through in-person consultations. Obviously, both situations not the best for them right now. They guided revenue down for the coming quarter to $800 to $840 million, a range, while the consensus was at $994 million. So a big guidance down there. They were citing less willingness from customers on new projects, kind of a bummer for Ciena as the move to cloud and more cybersecurity should be benefiting the company. Sounds like a management issue. It's a three-day weekend for investors. Labor Day next week for the market is closed, so enjoy the weekend, and perhaps that's signaling the end of summer for many, so enjoy it. Talk to you guys next week. Back to you, Jim.
When I testified in March to the Senate, one of the senators asked me, so how dependent are we? Tell us this in a context of coronavirus. And I said to him that I've had the privilege of talking with people who actually make our drugs. And I went around the table, this was at dinner one night, and these are four people with probably a combined 150 years experience in the industry. And they said, in unison, at least 90% of the core chemicals to make the medicines we need to care for people with coronavirus and help them recover come from China.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you know how lower interest rates will impact your income if you're retired or about to retire? Make sure you're prepared. Work with Financial Sense Wealth Management to help you develop a plan that provides you with predictable income no matter what happens in the markets. Don't take chances with your future. Let us show you how to avoid falling interest rates and loss of income. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, it seemed like stocks were going to go up indefinitely. Day after day, week after week, stocks kept climbing to new records. Well, on the day we're speaking, that is not the case. The Dow was down nearly 800 points. Is this a pullback, a correction, or something worse? Joining us on the program is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari, let's begin with the major indexes. It seemed like we were just heading after one record after another, especially when you look at the NASDAQ, the S&P, the Dow was lagging somewhat, but all of a sudden, bang, here we are, the Dow opening up down almost 800 points. We're down about 500 points as we're speaking. Let's talk about the markets. What are you seeing?
We're seeing, it's still an uptrend. I think as we talk about the indexes, down about 3% today from an all-time high. We have to remember that uptrends don't go in straight lines, even though it seems to be that case from time to time. And that consolidation is reasonable along the way. And that's what we think is happening. That after a terrific run-up into the recent highs, today's weakness hasn't been damaging is the point that we're seeing in our work. And ultimately, after a period to pause and digest the prior gains, we do think market strength should continue through the balance of the year and into 2021 as well. That, you know, a key point to our view is that, especially if you were to strip out technology, which has had a tremendous run, the market of stocks and most stock markets have actually had a very difficult two-year period dating back to 2018. And following that difficult two-year stretch, as we think about the Russell 2000, Russell 1000 Value, and MSCI All Country World ex-US, all at best flat since the start of 2018, we see a contrarian case for long-term upside, which is why we believe that the internals of the market are basing rather than topping, and one by one, key market areas should continue to participate on the upside and break to the upside and help extend the duration of this bull market.
You know, that's something that people often forget, and they call it the S&P 5, Ari, where you have five stocks within the S&P that are really dominating the index's upturn. But if you look at the S&P on an unweighted basis, it gives you a different picture on the charts.
If you were to look at the S&P equal weighted S&P 500, right, you're still below the February peak. And this really captures the much more muted returns that the S&P equal weighted is only up 6% dating back to its initial peak in January of 2018. We're generally of the view that January 2018 was a peak in risk when most global benchmarks topped out. And the action since then has been very difficult for risk. It's been difficult for the S&P equal weighted, and why we think the contrarian case, if the average stock can start acting better, which we think we're seeing signs of that, why we think the overall market should continue to work as well.
You know, what's interesting about this, at least in my lifetime, this is the first time that I've seen in, gosh, I can't remember, in decades, where the yield on a lot of the blue chip stocks that are in the Dow, whether you're looking at Coca-Cola, you're looking at what was once Pfizer in the Dow, or even Merck, some of these dividend yields on these stocks in the Dow are two or three times what you could get in the Treasury market. And it's not just the Dow, but if you look across the universe of stocks, there are dividend yields out there that are way above what you can get in the bond market today.
Yes, I think what you hit on there, Jim, is this idea that there is no alternative. That, it's been our view that, you know, it's really safety that is showing much more bubble-like characteristics. And safety is much more expensive just based on the valuations of equities versus the bond market. And so for that reason, we think the low rates that we're seeing is providing a floor for the equity market. If you look back historically, you really have to think of interest rates in terms of both level and direction. Historically, low and rising is good for stocks. Currently, we have low and stable. If you were to get any sort of signs of a backup in interest rates moving higher, you know, that's emblematic of the longer term green shoots and cyclicality that we think are starting to emerge and what could be that support for additional equity market gains.
Well, certainly when you listen, you know, most bull markets, at least in my lifetime, were triggered by Fed tightening cycles, and you certainly don't have that now. In fact, if you listen to Jerome Powell, he's made it very clear they're not even thinking about raising rates.
That's right. It gets to this idea, and it's an often used cliche, but it typically works, is this idea you don't fight the Fed. Marty Zweig's line from decades ago. And so the Fed came in very aggressively in March when the indexes were collapsing, and investors took that they were taking tail risk off the table. And so you saw investors fly into technology stocks at first that were, you were seeing them receive a premium in this low yielding backdrop, these higher growth companies. So it has been a very concentrated market that we'd like to see expand and broaden. And it's that idea of a concentrated market that's been this lingering concern. But the point is that it's not a bubble in the overall market. But we do see a bubble in sector dispersion as we think about the spread between the best and worst performing sector. That reading is at its highest really since the TMT bubble. But there's some differences between now versus then. Now, for instance, over the last 2 years, tech is up 60% and financials are coming off a reading of down 20%. That's capturing that spread. That's the dispersion. But if you look at history, tech being up 60% over 2 years is nice, but it's really far from the extremes of the late 90s when that 2 year rate of change peaked above 200%. So this is why we continue to stress that the steadiness of tech's advance is an underappreciated point. Now, on the flip side, over the last 30 years, that 20% decline in financials over a two-year period was only exceeded during the depths of the great financial crisis in 2009. So for us, it's don't blame tech's rally for the bifurcated returns. Blame the balance of the market because they haven't been able to keep pace. Now, as a reminder, it's not about lofty valuations when the cheapest stocks are the ones being hardest hit on the market downturns. So again, this just exemplifies the difficult market backdrop that we've endured for the last 2 years and why we think if that dispersion is going to come in to a more average level, it's going to occur on a broader market advance with deep value cyclicals acting better rather than a broad-based market decline.
So, Ari, you know, there's been some talk about the V-shaped recovery that we've seen in the stock market versus a V-shaped recovery in the economy. And if you look at two sectors, you mentioned one of them, financials, which are down, and also energy. So if we're looking at the economy to recover, would you not want to see financials, which deal with credit, and energy, which deal with industrial use and people being active, people driving cars, trucks delivering goods, would you not want to see those two recover?
We do. We don't want to see this very narrow market. We'd like to see it expand in these areas. Now, we would argue that quietly it's not necessarily those two, but you are seeing better action in cyclicals like housing, road and rail, and some select materials as well as and capital goods stock. So you are seeing some of the right leadership elsewhere. Semiconductors also very notable strength. In terms of those two sectors, you know, on one hand you have financials just handcuffed to the low interest rates that we described. So we do want to see them start to participate, and that's why we want to see rates start to move up, at least from a trading basis near term. That would be good for the market. We'd like to see financials act better. That's been a missing piece of the puzzle. And I think we can get there. I think rates overshot to the downside. Difficult to make the case for long-term upside in rates, especially with the Fed's commitment to keep rates low. And that's why we think there's going to continue to be this premium on growth. But at least to see a little bit of near-term reprieve and get rates up marginally and get financials to start to move to the upside in terms of their stock performance. Energy is a different story. So you have the energy sector coming off its lowest relative level since 1931. We are in this absolute destruction of this sector, this major secular bear market in energy that we don't think has run its course, but that's not necessarily bad for equities. Now, it's been our view that commodity prices are in a long-term secular range, that they're going to continue to oscillate and really lack direction. And so this is going to be that headwind facing the energy sector. But if you look back historically, prior periods of long-term secular ranges in commodity prices have overlapped with these tech-led secular bulls, namely the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s and 1980s. So to kind of answer the question, what do stocks like? Low commodities, high commodities? We think the answer is low and stable commodities. That's creating that price stability that we're seeing. That's, you know, I think a catalyst for the secular bull market that we're in.
I want to talk about another area that is emerging, and I want to talk about green. And when I speak about green, we're seeing more companies emerge. You know, it's not just Tesla anymore, whether it's Nikola, whether it's NIO, other companies with EV vehicles in terms of what that might mean for energy in the long term, but also what it might mean for certain commodities, Ari. And I'm thinking of copper and nickel. I mean, you had Elon Musk coming out and saying, look, if you're a mining company, please mine nickel. We'll sign a long-term contract with you. That, to me, was a key statement. If we're going green, we're still going to need raw materials.
Not having, you know, much thought on that idea in particular, I think it's interesting, and I'm going to give it more thought. It's not that we're calling for, you know, significantly lower commodity prices. I mean, for us, and agreed, you're seeing terrific action in the solar names and these autonomous vehicles. But the real big catalyst to what's going on in the commodity world is for us is the dollar. That it's the dollar has been in this ongoing range, and it's really helped in turn, due to their inverse correlation, create this range-bound commodity market where you've had points. And if you kind of rewind the clock, Q1, really the risk was deflation. The risk then was that you were going to continue with the market and the economy collapsing. The dollar was spiking, and the worry was that you were just going to continue to see dollar move higher and put this deflationary pressure on the market. Since then, it's actually gone the other way. Dollar has weakened, provided that reflationary tailwind. Commodities have rallied through that. And again, it's creating that price stability, I think, in terms because of the dollar. So, yeah, I think there's going to be rallies in nickel and copper and some of these areas, but I just don't think the dollar is going to be as weak as it was last decade when you had a 50% haircut in the DXY that helped attribute to that big, larger multi-year run-up in commodity prices. We don't see that set up.
So given what we're seeing in this market, and you and I are speaking on a day where the market's correcting, in terms of investing at this point, what would you be doing here? Because we don't know how long or deep or this correction will be, if you think that's what we're doing here. What would you be doing?
Well, we'd be buying stocks based on our view that the market is coming out of this difficult two-year period, that internals are basing, not topping, and you're going to see some better market action going forward, and then you're going to see the bull market continue and continue to broaden. We'd be using this near-term volatility and these pullbacks, which haven't been damaging to the trend, to buy stock. So, you know, for us, technology, healthcare remain dominant themes for the long run. We think these higher growth sectors should continue to receive that premium in this lower yielding environment. And I'd layer in some of those cyclical themes as well, housing, road and rail, capital goods. You know, and I would say on the flip side, you know, the greatest relative risk would be in the high dividend defensives that act like bonds, utilities, REITs, and telco. That, you know, a rising tide does indeed lift all boats, but those would be most at risk to rise at a lesser pace, you know, especially given some signs of frost in the bond market and those less attractive valuations.
If I was to sum up right now, the internals of the market, and this is something people don't see, they see the S&P hitting a new record, the NASDAQ, but underneath the surface, you know, those indexes are being carried by a handful of stocks, but underneath, you see the broader market just basing at this point, which in your estimation is a good sign.
That's correct. That the oddly enough, that the contrarian case could actually be for more upside rather than downside.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, tell them how they could do so.
They can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
As always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
You as well, Jim. Take care. Talk soon.
I do not think gold is in a bubble yet at all. Historically, what does gold correlate with? Measures of equity risk and volatility, and it's inversely correlated with the dollar. So we think the dollar is going to go down, and we think equity volatility is going to go up. We're not bearish on stocks, but equity volatility will go up for all those reasons I mentioned before. So that's one source of support. The second issue I already mentioned, long-term inflation expectations, if they're going up, then people want to hold gold in relation to that. They just correlate well. The third thing, and I think this is critical, is gold is a safe haven. It's something that will do well when other markets run into trouble. And historically, that's been government bonds' role the last 25 years. If you believe like us that that role is slowly shifting, then as a safe haven, people will reduce their exposure just as a hedge asset. They'll reduce their exposure to government bonds and increase their exposure to gold. By the way, this is also the attitude of a number of central banks, Russia and China being among the biggest ones. All this says that there's a gold bubble ahead. It's definitely not in the rearview mirror.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, if you're a precious metals investor, I don't care if you're invested in platinum, gold, or silver, or even the gold stocks, you've got to be a happy camper this year. It's been one of the best performing sectors in the markets. And where are we going to go from here? Will this trend continue? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, you've been a follower of silver for as long as I've known you. In fact, you introduced me, thank God, to silver back in the 00 decade. As we look at silver now, we got to a point earlier in the year where the gold to silver ratio, and I wonder if you'd spend a little time explaining this for our listeners, but it got to an extreme. I think, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but didn't it get to like 123? We had never seen anything that distorted before.
First off, a lot of people kind of blow back on the gold silver ratio like it's meaningless. First of all, the meaning is how many ounces of silver does it take to buy an ounce of gold? So, I mean, it's just an arithmetic formula. The other part of it is, of course, what does it mean in history versus now? And the 100-to-1 ratio has only been achieved twice in modern times. It's never gone above 100-to-1. It was on a spike and it came back down rather rapidly. And in both instances, it was actually showing or portended economic problems at that point in time. So since this is the highest it's ever been on a gold-silver ratio in 5,500 years, it suggests that we're probably going to face the most interesting economic conundrums we've probably ever seen. And of course, that's been my basic theme from when I started, that all fiat fails and that we're facing a crisis, currency crisis somewhere down the road. And I think we've just really begun into that last part of what's been unraveling for quite some time. But go a bit further. If you imagine a gold-silver ratio chart that's 52 feet long, where every foot represents one century, a chart that goes all the way back to 3200 BC, the ratio graph would stay below 16:1 for all but the last 17 or 18 inches. It's only in the last 173 years that the ratio has ever climbed above 16:1. And again, as I said, only three times in 5,200, 5,500 years, in 1941, 1991, and 2020.
Well, if we look at where we are on the day we're doing this interview on a Tuesday, that ratio is a little over 69. So, you know, coming down from 125 to 69, that is a sharp correction. Now, let's talk about something that's a little bit more unique with silver versus gold. Silver is also an industrial metal. We see, like for in California, every new home now is required to have some kind of solar panel. My house is completely powered by solar energy. So the more that we go towards clean energy, whether it's EVs or it's going to be solar panels, it requires raw materials like copper and silver. Let's talk about the industrial use of silver, because sometimes that clouds the investment and monetary use, which I believe was one of the reasons that ratio got as high as it did, because we were experiencing weak economic growth globally in a recession.
Exactly. Silver, risk of offending anyone, is bipolar at times, meaning that at times it acts almost only as a monetary metal, and other times it acts strictly as an industrial metal. What's interesting on the industrial side is the overall trend. If you look at the amount that was used on industry back 20 years ago in 2000, it was about 35% of the total. And at that time, we were mining about 550 million ounces on an annual basis. Today, silver's industrial usage represents 50, 55, even up to 60% of the total based on either CPM study or the Silver Institute. So we'll just say 50%. So it's gone from 35% to 50% in those 20 years, and we're now mining 850 million ounces of silver on an annual basis. So clearly the industrial usage of silver has been increasing on an annual basis. There are some years where it flattens out, all things go up and down, but the general trend is what I just explained. Going a step further, there are new uses for silver all the time, And we will see the margin is where you get the increase in price. In other words, even at 60%, that's not enough to push the price higher. It's always been monetary investment demand that takes silver into the higher price range. What's interesting this time is the demand for silver for monetary demand is increasing rapidly over the last few months. And I think it's possible that we'll see a situation where some of the industrial users that have taken silver for granted that they can get it at any time are going to find how tight the supply is right now. And they may have to come in at higher prices, and they may even go into stockpiling it for a while because it's going to be perhaps disrupting their supply chains.
So, Dave, let's move on to another metal, and that's copper, because we're moving more and more towards EVs. You have companies like Nikola right now. They're going to be making semi-trucks, garbage trucks, vans that are going to run on batteries and green power. You've got Tesla. You've got NIO. All of these car companies that are now putting out electric vehicles require more uses of copper. So let's talk about copper, because on the day that you and I are talking, copper looks like it's breaking out. It's over $3. So let's talk about what you think about copper and where it might be heading.
Jim, I'm not as bullish on copper perhaps as you are. I agree with everything you said on a fundamental basis, and technically correct. We are above the $3 level. There's a lot of congestion in the copper market between about 320, 325, and the $3 level. So it does have to get through some of that overhead resistance, which it's obviously capable of doing. Really depends on where we go from here. My take presently, subject to change, is that the disruption in the supply chain, not only of food, but energy as well, has not going to be resolved easily. And because of that fact, we're going to see probably a delay in some of the electric vehicles coming to the market. We have an oversupply of automobiles, both gas-powered and diesel-powered, that's basically been channel stuffing, which is the slang term for all these auto dealerships, even in my area, where you see just mountains of cars that can't be sold. So they'll have to be discounted and move into the market. So longer term depends how we come through the next few years for me to get extremely bullish on copper. But let me just conclude that the market knows more than me. And if we get above the 325 level and stay at that level for a while, obviously the market's saying, and I have to pay attention, hey, copper's on its way. So I'll reevaluate if we get slightly higher and maintain that level for a while.
So listen, as we close, Dave, if our listeners would like to follow your work, explain in the Morgan Report, because you cover the commodity space, not just silver, but you cover all of the natural resource sector. Tell our listeners about your newsletter.
Well, thank you, Jim. Yes, the easiest thing to do is get on our free newsletter, and that's just go to our main landing page, which is themorganreport.com. Don't forget themorganreport.com. Also, we have a premium service. You can drop down on the subscribe page and see the different services that we offer. But I would like everyone to be well aware of our blog, because I do a lot of interviews in the public domain, and I'm having a summation written every week on what I've talked about during the week. And lastly, I do a weekly perspective, which is a wrap-up of the big picture news on a global basis. And then I usually end with a few minutes on the metals, and that's usually 15 minutes or less. So it's a good summation for people that don't have a lot of time to waste to get an overview of what's going on in the global economy with my take on it, and then kind of a wrap-up on the metals. So that's it. I am appreciative always of being with Financial Sense, and I wish everyone a great Labor Day weekend that's in the U.S. And if you're not, anywhere you are, enjoy your weekend.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava, CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, when we spoke to you 2 weeks ago, you talked about how the level of tech concentration was above that which we saw in the tech bubble. You were saying how Apple is 54% above its 200-day moving average. That's the widest we've seen since the October 2007 top. Momentum was not sustainable, and you wouldn't be surprised if we saw a consolidation or a sharp pullback over the next couple weeks. And obviously, that's what we saw this week. So given the sharp pullback that we saw, particularly in the overly valued tech stocks, can you give us an assessment of the level of damage that we've seen and just a general update on where you see the markets at currently?
You know, Chris, I think the pullback that we saw was very healthy. I mean, the last thing you want to see is a runaway bubble like we saw in 2000, where the whole market gets extended, because parabolic moves on the upside tend to have parabolic moves on the downside. They rarely resolve themselves quietly. And so it is healthy to see a pullback. I mean, it was getting very, very frothy in some of these tech names. But what I would like to point out, though, and the reason why I don't think this is the shot across the bow or in terms of, you know, the general market of really putting in a significant top, was, you know, I took a look at it yesterday, and despite the market being down nearly 4%, there was actually a lot of underlying strength in the market, where over 10% of the 500 stocks in S&P, so I counted around 53, 56 stocks, were actually up yesterday. No surprise, none of them were in the tech sector, but it does kind of show that the tech sector, with how big they are, how massive they are, they really are becoming the market, or I would say they are becoming the index. So if you think of the index, you know, you're kind of are starting to just think of tech with their massive size and weight. And yesterday, just to kind of get ahead of the news, we put out a note to clients, just kind of highlighting that really this sell-off was really driven by the tech sector. And because there really was no major catalyst yesterday. But what wanted to highlight was that when I looked at the performance for the S&P through September 2nd, what I found was astounding, that the tech sector made up 81% of the entire return for the year. 81% by one sector. What was, to me, even more astounding than that was that just three stocks out of the 500 that make up the S&P were responsible for 75% of the return. Three out of 500 stocks made up 75% of this year's return, which is crazy. And, you know, we all know who they are. They're going to be the usual suspects. You know, Apple was number one. It was responsible for 31% of the S&P's return through September 2nd. Amazon coming at number two at contributing 24% of the return. And Microsoft came in at 20%. Now, you know, if we add the other names that a lot of people are familiar with, Nvidia, PayPal, Alphabet, they actually accounted for 101% of S&P's return, meaning they offset any of the all the companies that had a negative return for the year. So we clearly were being pushed and influenced by the tech sector, and it was more than due for a pause.
So it sounds like what you said is that this has so far been a healthy pullback, and one of the main reasons is because we're seeing overvalued tech stocks sell off, but at the same time, we're seeing a lot of the undervalued places of the market, perhaps where there's some value, as we've been discussing on our show, that those were actually starting to appreciate. So it looks like there's been a rotation of some sort, if we could say that.
I would. And, you know, one of the benefits that we have, especially for listeners, is we have some really good technicians, market strategists on the show. And, you know, one of them is Bullseye Craig Johnson. His price targets for the S&P year after year are astoundingly close. He's done a phenomenal job and consistent. And another technician that I really respect a lot that we've had on the show is John Krinsky from Baycrest Partners. And what, you know, he's been kind of cautioning the market in terms of, you know, tech being long overdue for a pullback. And interestingly enough, his note this week, before the sell-off occurred, he was pointing out that if we're partying like it's 1999, let's not forget what rallied in 2000. And he was highlighting that the NASDAQ fell 55% from its high in early 2000 into its December low, while during that exact same period, the S&P Bank Index rose 50% in the same time. And if you look at the S&P 500 industrial sector, they rallied 30%, even while tech sold off. But because tech made such a large portion of the market, the S&P was declining during that time period, and yet you had sectors and industries rallying 30 to 50%. And specifically, he looked at March 10th, 2000 through the end of the year. And while you see the tech sector was down 47%, commercial services were down, or communication services were down 38%, consumer staples were up 57%, utilities up 51%, financials up 46%, healthcare up 42%, industrials up 20%, energy up 16%, even materials were up 7%. So what this means is, you know, I kind of use the example of the forest for, you know, through the trees, is that you have to understand when you think of the index, the Dow, the S&P, you're really thinking of the tech sector given its outsized influence. So just like tech stocks can be really the only thing that is rallying for the year, while most stocks were down until just recently for year-to-date performance, they can also hide the strength in the market when they're falling, yet parts of the market are actually strengthening. So, you know, really the idea is that you're going to have a bull market as long as money is gravitating to other areas. It's when money gravitates out of stocks and into cash or bonds, that's when you can see a bear market in stocks. But as long as cash that is in equities stays within equities, meaning it's rotating to other areas, other sectors, other industries, that's when the bull market can stay alive if you're in the right area. So he had a really great point to point that out. And one of the things that I took a look at is we've got a great portfolio manager, part of our team, Ryan Price, and he's very skilled with coding and Excel. And he created a spreadsheet where we can kind of look at some stats. And what I did is I looked at the NASDAQ 100, and I wanted to see when it's greater than 30% away from its 200-day moving average, meaning it's very extended like we had recently. What does its performance look like? And outside of a few instances in the early 90s, the bulk of the events where this occurred were 98 through 2000. And when we look at the one-year median performance, the NASDAQ was down in the following year by about 9%, meaning it went through a prolonged consolidation. While if you look at the unconditional one-year returns for the NASDAQ, historically, if you just look at all the periods, not just the times where it was extended, its annual return is around 16%. So that is a huge differentiation. Normally, if you just look at a one-year period for the NASDAQ, it's up 82% of the time. However, if you're looking at those instances in which it's really extended away from its 200-day moving average by 30% or more, it's only up 42% of the time. So what this tells me is that I would not be surprised, just like I mentioned 2 weeks ago, to expect to see tech stocks, the NASDAQ, undergo a short-term correction. I wouldn't be surprised if we look 1 year out from now that the tech sector is not the leading sector of the market, that we could see phenomenal returns in other areas, cyclical areas like industrials and materials and energy, financials, if the recovery continues as it has since the bottom in economics in March, April. So, you know, that's kind of what my thought is. And we have some data to back that up statistically.
You know, Chris, it was interesting because this week we spoke with Alpine Macro's David Abramson, and he had made a case for this bull market to continue and that we would see a rotation from tech and growth into the more cyclical areas, particularly industrials, materials, and commodities. And they're looking at the first half of next year to be really when we see that trend accelerate. We might be in the early stages of that. What is it in particular that you're looking at that you think also corroborates this view that, you know, the bull market is going to continue, but we're likely to see this ongoing rotation?
You know, one of the things I look at is breadth. You never want to see, for example, the stock market going up by only a handful of names. You know, that typically marks a bull market top. And that's what we saw in February. In February, it really was the tech sector leading the charge where almost all of the other sectors were down. And then also, if you look at other major market tops like 2000 or 2007, again, it was a handful of names that were driving most of the performance. And conversely, I also look at breadth in terms of the economy. You know, I don't want to see only a handful of states leading the charge in terms of employment or growth. I want to see a widespread improvement in terms of states that are growing, you know, all 50 states ideally. And so one of the things I do when I look at the stock market is I want to see, is there a broad participation in the rally? Or are there some areas in terms of weakness? You know, is the market going up while all, you know, a good portion of the market is also going down? And there's a famous omen, it's called the Hindenburg omen. And there's some requirements on it that it's predominantly done on the NYSE. But I like to apply it on stock-only indices. So think of, you know, the small cap Russell 2000, the S&P mid cap, large cap, and the NASDAQ, the Dow. So these are only stocks. And often at times at major market peaks, we're seeing a bunch of these warning signs, meaning that the market is going higher, being led by, you know, fewer and fewer companies. So we saw actually a lot of Hindenburg omens going into the February top in the market. We also saw a lot of these going into the September peak in 2018 before the big correction. And what I want to point out is I don't see a single Hindenburg omen on any of the major indices. So what that tells me is that the market is going up. It's just that tech is running so much further ahead of everyone else. But we do see participation, that the broad market is improving. And conversely, you know, looking at 2016, going into the November elections, there also was a lack of Hindenburg omens going into the election, but yet we still had a sell-off. So, you know, again, I wouldn't be surprised if we have some market jitters going into the election with being such a tight race and so much at stake that the market abhors uncertainty for the market to remain weak over the next month or two. However, what I wouldn't want listeners to think is that that weakness would spell the idea that we're possibly putting in a bull market top. I don't believe that. Typically, what you see is that most bear markets occur when the Fed is either tightening or is an extended period of that, or you see in terms of spare capacity in the economy is very low, meaning unemployment rates are at the low end, manufacturing industrial capacity is at the upper end, that there's not a lot left to squeeze out of the economy. And that's not the case. You know, if you think back to going into this year with a record low unemployment rate, that was the case. And that's why we were a bit cautious before the market top, was we had Fed was starting to cut interest rates. However, there was really not much to squeeze out of the economy. And we clearly have that now. You have an elevated unemployment rate, which is moving in the right direction. It's falling. However, if you think about where we are, the Fed is now at our back. The Fed is a tailwind, not a headwind. And one of the studies that we did this week is we wanted to see what the stock market's performance, particularly looking at the S&P 500, what its performance is in various regimes and based on the federal funds rate. And we made up six groups. We wanted to look at what happens when we're at the end of a rate cutting cycle to the beginning of when the Fed starts to raise rates. And we broke that into its first half and second half of when the Fed raises. We also looked at stages when the Fed is done raising rates up until the point at which it has its first rate cut. And then we looked at the cutting cycle. You know, how does the stock market perform in the first half of a rate cutting cycle and in the second half? And in our opinion, you know, if you think back to September, that's when the Fed was cutting rates. The Fed's at zero right now. It continued to cut rates this year. And now they're printing money. Printing money is effectively like an interest rate cut. It's supportive for the markets. And so we think we're in that stage or the second half of a rate cutting cycle. And what we found was in this phase or the second half of a rate cutting cycle, the average compounded annual growth rate of the S&P 500 was 30%. Its maximum loss that we ever saw in those periods was a 14% loss. But of all the periods in which we're in the second half of a rate cutting cycle, the S&P's averaged a 30% return. Now, the next phase that we classified is after you're done cutting rates, you're done adding stimulus, essentially that period all the way up until when the Fed first raises interest rates. That's where we're going to go next after the Fed's done printing money. It's then that period all the way until its first rate hike. So that period, which we classify as an early expansion, the average S&P's compounded growth rate was 32%. So we are in the sweet spot for stock returns relative to the interest rate raising or tightening or easing cycle by the Fed. So this is why we remain bullish despite any volatility that might occur around the election.
And as you said 2 weeks ago, you said that clients currently, Financial Sense Wealth Management clients, are in a neutral to slightly above neutral posture since the Fed is still a major tailwind, not thinking of raising rates, and that we would be looking to add more exposure to client portfolios during another correction. That brings us to this week since we did see a correction. So what are we doing for clients as of now?
We did take some profits in a few stocks that were extremely extended. And so rates a little bit of cash, but we're not heading to the, you know, into our bunker. And again, as I mentioned, I think we still have some stock market gains that the Fed is behind us. It's not ahead of us as a headwind. And so what we're planning on doing for clients is moving towards more exposure to equities, less than fixed income and cash, if we have an opportunity of a sell-off leading into the election. So if there is weakness ahead or any volatility, we'll be using that to increase our exposure to the stock market, in particular into cyclical areas. But again, with the market as extended as it was, we haven't been putting money to work recently. We want to wait for a pullback before we get more aggressive. And again, because we feel that we are still very early in this bull market that began in March of 2020, and also this new expansion that began.
So it sounds like you're expecting more of a pullback ahead, that this correction's not over, and you'll still be using that as an opportunity to buy in?
That's correct. I still think that there's the market needs to cool off, and there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot at stake in terms of economic growth, tax rates. There's a lot of divide between Trump as well as Biden's political views. So there is, again, a lot at stake. And so with that uncertainty in such a close election, I have a hard time seeing the stock market rally prior to the election. So I do think there could be some weakness ahead. But again, we welcome it. We would be adding to exposure to the market. And because we do feel there's a lot more runway ahead of this market.
Chris, as we close, would you mind telling our listeners some of the various services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, either for individual investors, institutions, corporations, and the like?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance, particularly with interest rates at 0%.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks. Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour and our Smart Macro segment with Chris Poplava. Again, if you'd like to give him a call to discuss his investment outlook or to speak with any of our financial advisors, you can do so by giving us a call at 888-486-3939. We do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.